Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. Singing songs such as the ones we've just sang, I would like to think anyway, bring a smile to our faces, put a little hop in our step or something like that. And that's a good thing. I will tell you this, all things being equal, I would prefer to be happy. I've met a couple of people in my life where I wasn't quite sure if that was the case. It seemed like they were just absolutely determined to not be happy, and they were going to find a way to do it. But generally speaking, I think I speak for most of us, if not all of us. Why not, right? We'd rather be happy than not happy. Surely happiness is a good thing. And when you live in a society such as ours, where most of us don't really have to concern ourselves too much with the necessities of the day, don't need to really worry about our lives, our safety, basic human rights, basic human requirements and such, we at least have a decent shot at being happy. And as it's the way this tends to work, the happier we get, the higher our bar gets, right? We'll be happy at this level. And we get there, now we want to be happy at this level. And then we want to be happy at this level. It just keeps going up and going up. And that's fine as far as that goes. I'm not discouraging that. I am going to try to put it a little bit in perspective here this evening. And it kind of goes along with some of the things we said this morning. This quest for happiness, this unabated mad rush for happiness in our society, comes with some problems. We have convinced ourselves that if we are not happy, however we may define happy at that given time, then somehow life is a ruin, life is a wreck, that the circumstances of our life make it impossible for us to be satisfied, impossible for us to be content in the life that we have, whatever state that may be in. And the good news is I have a solution for that. I'm going to suggest to you that you need to find your happiness in Jesus. And not necessarily as much in the things of the world, in your money or your possessions or your relationships or things of that nature. I say that's good news because Jesus, unlike all those other things, is always available to you. Being happy in Jesus is just a choice. And so therefore, you would figure, all things being equal, that it'd be preferable. If you want to be happy, surely it'd be better to be happy in an endeavor where you have every reason to expect success versus finding happiness in being a millionaire or owning half of Florida or whatever, you know, wherever you may draw the line arbitrarily, where you have very little chance, if any, of getting there. Nevertheless, I have experienced, and you have too, one person after another, Christians, good people, people that we had confidence in, people that we had faith in, people who shared our faith in Jesus Christ, turn away from Jesus. Reject him, in part or in whole. And when you ask them about that, they get all frustrated and yeah, you're right. Maybe I'm not doing what I ought to do. But here's the thing. I'm happy now. And presumably, we're supposed to take away from this that because you're happy, that and happy in the conventional sense of the word, the way most people would use the word, because you're happy, therefore, we should just kind of let all this rest of the stuff go. That it doesn't matter so much that your soul is lost or that you're going to miss your home in heaven or anything like that. Because the important thing is that you're happy now, as you may define happiness at any given moment in your life. I'm going to urge you here this evening to fight that. And to urge you to find your contentment in Jesus. I'm not suggesting that you can't have some level of happiness in this life. I'm saying that when that becomes our goal, A, we put our faith at risk, and B, we minimize the true joy, the true satisfaction, the true contentment that is available in Jesus, that bottom line is not going to be available in all those other things, no matter how much of it you get. Only Jesus is going to provide the true happiness, the true contentment and joy that we're looking for. So what I'm going to do is emphasize a few aspects of our quest for happiness here this evening, and hope you can follow along and take some notes perhaps and take some lessons away from this. As always, if we say something that's not true to the Scriptures, let us know, because we want more than anything else to be right with God. I fear greatly that most people out there in the world, if not all, and many of our brethren, are consumed with the wrong kind of happy. They are very interested in being happy, like all the rest of us are, but the wrong kind, the carnal kind. And we're going to describe this quest for happiness in a few generalities here this evening. A self-serving kind of happiness. And I don't mean that necessarily in a critical kind of way, because conventional happiness is by its very nature selfish. Now, there is a sense, probably, in which if you're a nice person, if you're a giving person, a generous kind of person, that you get some level of satisfaction by making somebody else happy. I get that, and that's fine, that's good. But most of the time, when people are asked about their level of happiness out there in the world, it's about what's happening to them. How much or how little they have of this, that, or the other. Now, we're told in Scriptures that the godly attitude, the Jesus attitude to have towards such things, is to avoid this self-centeredness, to get more toward a other-centeredness, and certainly a Jesus-centeredness in our life. Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, a text that you're familiar with, I'm sure, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves." And he goes on to explain exactly how that worked, and Jesus' own example of giving and putting others before himself, going to the cross is the obvious example of that. Do nothing, he says. And you know, I've said this before, I'll say this again. We have this urge that is thrust upon us in our society to make time for me, to find our own way, to make sure that we get enough of our own, go for the gusto, whatever kind of lingo is going on with the commercials these days. And when it doesn't seem like the dice are rolling our way, when it doesn't seem like it's been our day or our week or our year or our decade, we may find ourselves frustrated. We will find ourselves frustrated. And asking ourselves, it's all fine and good that things are going well for other people, but when does it get to be about me? When do I get what I want out of life? When do I become the one that I can focus on a little bit? And the Jesus, like it or not, the answer that we get overwhelmingly over and over again in the Bible is never. It never gets to be all about me, ever, in my life. That's a hard reality, but it's a Bible reality. He doesn't say do most things or do hardly anything from selfishness or empty conceit. Consider most people more important than ourselves. No, this is an absolute. It's a couple of absolutes. Self-servingness is counter to the gospel appeal. And you get this all the time with divorce. You find somebody who's going through a bad marriage, and then I think I'm going to get a divorce. I found somebody else, and he makes me happy, or she makes me happy. Well, that's just great. Okay, so you're happy in this new state. Okay, what about your ex? What about your children? What about your neighbors, your friends, the other people in your life? At what point did your own personal happiness become more important than anybody else's happiness in the entire world? Why should we excuse the misery that you're thrusting upon other people because you yourself are happy today? Doesn't that sound kind of selfish? And isn't selfishness the exact opposite of what we're required to be in Jesus Christ. Now, there are other problems with divorce that we're not going to get into here in this context. But in whatever relationship we want to talk about here with your children, with your neighbors, or whatever, just because you yourself are not getting what you want out of life, that doesn't mean the world is broken any more than it was before anyway. It's not just about being what we want out of life to the exclusion of what anybody else wants. Short-term thinking. The idea of only focusing on this life. Only focusing on the things that pertain to right now. That's what children do. Some of you are children or used to be children. And you remember how this works, right? Children are happy in the short term. If you promise them a cookie in 15 minutes, they immediately become miserable, right? We're not interested in 15 minutes. We want the cookie now. And until we get the cookie, we're going to be unhappy. When we get the cookie, then we can talk about being happy, maybe, for an extra 5 seconds. And then we'll see what happens after that. That's the way kids are. We expect kids to be like that. We don't blame them for that. Grown-ups are supposed to be different. We're supposed to have grown to realize that really not only some joys, but the biggest joys in this life come from waiting. We do not get them all at once. We do not get them right now. We build toward them. And that's actually kind of part of the excitement. That's part of the joy, the anticipation of this coming up. Jesus says in John chapter 6 and verse 27 that we're not supposed to labor for the meat or the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life. Having something that makes you happy or contented or filled, literally or metaphorically, in this life, in the short term is fine as far as that goes. But when our short-term pursuits interfere with our long-term objectives, we have a problem here. Your immediate happiness is interfering with your internal happiness. We need to think bigger than that. We need to think longer term than that. It's not just a matter of scratching whatever particular itch you may have at any given moment. And ultimately, in the long run, in the big picture, an entire life searching for an unending series of satisfying moments is going to wear you out. I like roller coasters much as the next person. I do not want to live on a roller coaster. I think that I would die very quickly. I'd start rooting for it to break down or something. Yeah, it's just, you can't do that. That's just exhausting. Luke chapter 12, verse number 20 and 21, at the tail end of this story that Jesus tells about this rich farmer who has been very rich toward himself and enjoyed a lot of short-term benefits and is using those short-term benefits to secure what he considers to be a long-term blessing. Soul, you have much goods laid up for many years, etc. And it turns out that very night his soul is required of him. He's not going to get to enjoy any of these things. All the happiness that he had in mind for himself for an extended period of time, he's not going to enjoy any of it. And Jesus caps it off by saying in verse 21, so is the man who stores up treasure for himself. It is not rich toward God. That's long-term thinking. That's big-picture thinking. That may or may not be in harmony with your plans for short-term happiness. When given the choice, we have to have enough courage to look for the right kind of happiness, not just the short-term thrills. All this has to do with being fleshly or being carnal. The Spanish majors among you recognize the word carne in carnal. It's talking about meat, talking about physical things. Carnal life is a fleshly life, a life of the flesh, which again is not a bad thing necessarily, except when it is used in contrast to a spiritual life. We all live a carnal life, can't help it, for our 70 or 80 years, whatever. We live in the flesh. Now, in the flesh, are we going to be prioritizing fleshly things, or are we going to be prioritizing spiritual things? If you prioritize fleshly things, carnal things, you'll probably enjoy more short-term happiness, as the word would generally define happiness. You'll go to more parties, you'll do more drugs, you'll fornicate more often, and you know, all the various things that the world thinks is entertaining. And they'll look at you askance because you don't. Why in the world would you not engage in these kind of things? Look how happy I am. Look at how happy we are. You could be like this too. And sometimes it works. Sometimes we're brought over to that side. But eventually, the thoughtful person, perhaps on his deathbed, the person who truly comes to appreciate the shortcomings of this kind of lifestyle, we'll get to where Solomon got in the book of Ecclesiastes. He's looking back at a lifetime of such efforts, fleshly efforts. And there are many admonitions that are found in Ecclesiastes. I point to chapter 2, verse 11. After having dealt specifically with all these things that Solomon did, what a wonderful, magnificent, full life Solomon was able to live. And then he says, I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. Now, profit's kind of an interesting choice of words given how much money Solomon had. You know, surely Solomon's life would have been worth something. As rich as he was, as much as he had of the world's goods, of the world's knowledge, of the world's women, certainly. There's got to be some kind of value in there somewhere. Solomon says, no. None of it. It was all vanity. It was great at the time. But now, after a lifetime, looking back, you realize how worthless all of it was. Now, hopefully, we will be, as I believe Solomon is here, we have enough time to come to our senses and make perhaps some measure of correction, moral correction certainly, and perhaps correction in other areas as well, so we can bring ourselves more in harmony of God's kind of life for us before it's too, you know, too late, everlastingly too late, as we sometimes say. But how much better would it be if we never went down that road at all? If instead of wasting 40 years or 50 years or 60 years of our life, instead we invested that in spiritual happiness, and on our deathbed we're looking back at a life and we're proud of what we've done. It brings us great joy to reflect on certainly a life full, you know, full of mistakes, but a life generally speaking that was pointed towards spiritual goals that you find yourself on the brink of realizing. Like Paul says, as he writes his letter to Timothy, I fought the good fight, I finished the course, I've kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness. What a wonderful thing to be able to say as your life starts to come to a close. Wouldn't you rather say that than said, I spent 50 years of my life chasing every bit of happiness I could possibly find. I wore myself out, I exhausted myself, and here I am at the end, I got nothing to show for it. Certainly not a relationship with God. That's the wrong kind of happy. And I suggest to you that when this is your goal, when you measure your life based on how many trips to Disney World you get, or how many horsepower you have in your car, or square footage in your house, or whatever it happens to be, dollars in your bank account, whatever your measuring stick is, if that's how you define happiness, you're going to wind up with some problems. First of all, and perhaps most importantly, you're going to miss out on opportunity after opportunity to grow your faith. Because this pell-mell chase toward physical things, things that I can see, things that I can touch, things that I can taste, when this is our only priority, realize this is exactly the opposite of a life of faith. God says he's going to bless me. Well, that's all fine and good, but I want to bless myself right now. I want to see something. I want to drive something on a real benefit, tangible benefit from my commitment to Jesus Christ or whatever. And if I can't get it out of Jesus, I'll get it from someplace else. The faith that we grow is a confidence that helps us endure when, in the short term, it seems like there doesn't appear to be a great deal of opportunity to be happy. And it gets us through. Like Paul with his so-called thorn in the flesh. He talks about this in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7 and following. And emphasizes the problem that he had. And I believe it's a spiritual problem. I don't think this is he didn't have enough money or his clothes itched or something, you know, silly like that. I think there's some kind of real issue that Paul is wrestling with, that's interfering with his work, and he wants it taken away, and God says, no, we're not going to do that. You're going to be unhappier, as it were, in the short term than you would have been if you had that thorn removed. Well, that's not the news Paul was looking for. How does he respond? He says in verse number 9, he said to me, Jesus said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. You're going to find a way to be satisfied with what I am giving you rather than yearning for what I'm not giving you, what you wish I would give you. Most gladly, therefore, he says, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, so the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I'm well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. What a wonderful attitude to take. And I would suggest to you that if Paul can take this attitude, when things are coming up in his life that are interfering with his spiritual pursuits, then surely we can find some degree of satisfaction and contentment in our life when much less is happening to us of a problematical nature for much less noble reasons. Now, I didn't get the raise. I didn't get the promotion. I didn't get the grade. I didn't get the girl. You know, whatever it happens to be that you thought was everything in the short term and you didn't get it. Do you realize that when you pursue your happiness in Jesus, you can have your happiness anyway, even if you don't get the initial thing that you think you want? And if you push back against that, if you say, God, it's not that I'm ungrateful for what I have, but this is what I really want, and when I get that, then we can talk about faith, and we can talk about service and all that. Before too long, if you're not careful, it's going to breed seeds of discontent in your life. And watching other people succeed in fleshly things, watching other people find success where you are not finding success, may make it worse. James chapter 1 and verse number 12 and 13. James is telling us here about the God who gives us gifts, or as it happens in some situations, doesn't give us gifts. And he blesses that God, and blesses the man who serves that God. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, for once he's been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God himself cannot be tempted by evil. He himself does not tempt anyone. Go through in verse number 13 there. What God do we serve? Do we serve the God who scratches every itch that we possibly have? Or do we serve the God who is going to take us to heaven when we die? The God who is our ultimate benefactor, who gives us the air we breathe, the life that we have in our bodies, you know, every cell in our body. If this is the God that we serve, then surely we serve him at all times, grateful for what he has done, rather than being resentful of what we haven't, what he hasn't done. Similarly, the idea of character growth. Did your parents ever refuse to give you something that was perfectly obvious you should have gotten? You know, it's getting to that time of year, right? Where everybody's got something they need, something they want. And you ask mom, you ask dad, we'll see. And then you don't get it. Well, what's the deal with that? And they say, well, it just didn't work out that way. That's okay. It's more important to build your character. That really fixes everything, doesn't it? Oh, I'm going to have a better character after it. Well, that's a whole lot better than the toy train. Thank you very much, Dad. Maybe not, right? That's probably not what we think about. Character growth is the last thing in the world your average 8-year-old is looking for. Well, it ought not be the last thing in the world a 28-year-old or an 88-year-old needs to be looking for. We realize that oftentimes, by not getting what we ask for, we get something far more important. And if we define our life and the success in our life simply by whether or not we got the thing that we asked for from God, from mom and dad, whatever, that's the way animals think. That's the way children think. There's no growth there. There's no maturity there. Do I get what I want? Do I not get what I want? That's a very simplistic way of looking at life. We ought to be growing out of that. We ought to be realizing there's more important things. There's other people. There's other priorities. There's other perspectives. There's heaven. And perhaps by not getting things, we're more blessed than we would have been if we had gotten them. You don't grow your relationships. If you define the quality of your life based on how much stuff you get, oftentimes at the expense of people who otherwise might have gotten it, do you see why that might interfere with your ability to function effectively and lovingly with your fellow man, and especially with your fellow Christian? Do you see that by being encouraged, sometimes beyond your control, to share, to jointly participate in things, to not get everything for yourself, to see the blessings that other people are getting and rejoicing with them as they rejoice, that that might help in terms of feeding your relationships with one another? The love that we have described for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, a text that all of us are very well familiar with, part of that description in verse number 5 is that love does not seek its own. That's the way the New American Standard Bible reads, and most of yours are going to be similar there. What is that? Love does not seek its own. My relationship with my wife, with my best friend, with my children, whatever, is defined exclusively based on whether I get what I want out of that relationship. If I am getting everything that I want, it's great. If I'm not getting what I really want, then it's bad. That's how I define the relationship. Well, can you see some flaws in that? Can you see that by exclusively focusing on our own situation, our own wants, our own needs, to the exclusion of others, that can hinder, well, husband's wife is probably the best example of that. If you have a marriage, we'll talk to the guys. Husbands, if you have a marriage where you're getting absolutely everything that you want every hour of every day of every year, your wife is miserable. Okay? And you probably don't know it because you're too busy being happy. And one of these days, you're going to run out of happiness. I hate to break it to you. It may take a year, it may take 5 years, but one of these days, you're going to wake up, you know, I don't know if you're going to wake up one morning missing a body part or something, but it's going to be bad. You cannot sustain a relationship like that. It's not reasonable to try to do so. And when we talked about Romans chapter 15, I believe, if I remember right this morning, the idea of serving one another, our commitment, our long-term commitment to putting others first, to edifying others, pursuing the welfare of others, as it says here in this context, pleasing your neighbor for his good, to his edification. Jesus Christ did not please himself. He wasn't concerned about what made him happy in the short term. He was about what was going to make us happy in the long term. Doing what's best for the group, doing what's best for mankind, for society, for his people, for his family. That's what was motivating him. Why can't it motivate us also? The more you seek your own personal satisfaction, first and foremost, the more damage you're going to do to your relationships. And I suggest to you that one of these days you're going to realize that you wanted that relationship a whole lot more than you wanted those things that you got in the relationship. There are lots of divorced men and women out there in the world who've come to realize that the hard way. Maybe we can learn it the easy way. Now,
We read from Matthew chapter 15, chapter 5, rather, the first few verses of Matthew chapter 5, and that would be a series of sermons in and of itself. We're not going to preach a series of sermons. But what I do want to do before we close up here is talk a little bit about the lifestyle that Jesus suggests that we pursue, the lifestyle that he blesses. Now, oftentimes, some versions, I think, still translate this word that most of our versions have, blessed. Some versions have happy, and I've known of at least one preacher who insisted that blessed and happy are the same thing. They're not. They're not the same thing. Not in the way that we usually use the word happy, at least. What Jesus is doing is he is putting his approval on a certain lifestyle. This is where you can find not just short-term contentment, but long-term contentment and a relationship with God and all the eternal implications that come with that. This is the lifestyle that Jesus approves of, and implicitly he rejects all the other lifestyles. The opposites of you could preach this sermon negatively, I suppose. This is the lifestyle that I don't bless. But you read the text with us a few moments ago. We'll review a little bit. In Matthew chapter 5, verse number 3, we'll skip the introduction and go to verse number 3. Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn," i.e. mourn for sin. I think it's the text there. "For they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle," or the meek, "for they shall inherit the earth." All these having to do generally with the concept of humility. Not me first, and certainly not me only, but rather a lifestyle of promoting somebody else to our own detriment. Poor in spirit. If you go up to the average person out there in the world and say, "My objective in life is to become more poor in spirit," they're going to think you're crazy. And if they fully understand what poor in spirit means, they're going to think you're really crazy. Why would you want that? Why would you want to diminish your own welfare and your own priorities? Not get your own way. It's kind of similar to being meek or gentle. Everybody there in the world says, you got to go get what you want. Go take it. Take it by force if you have to. Go take control of your destiny. God says, Jesus says here, no, you allow life to happen. You allow God to be in control. And you accept whatever happens to come your way, trusting that God is taking care of you. Well, why in the world would you want to do that? Because you're a person of faith. And because Jesus says you'll be blessed in that lifestyle. The path to glory is not going to be through self-promotion. It's not going to be through self-glorification. It's going to be through his grace. God gives grace to the humble, the text says in James chapter 4, verse 6. Therefore, we're supposed to humble ourselves in the sight of the Lord so that he will lift us up. That should give a great deal of comfort and satisfaction to us as Christians. The confidence that God is taking care of us in the long term. I don't have to glorify myself right now because the main thing is my eternal glory, and God has that covered. And therefore, I can be humble. I can be lowly in this life. It was good enough for Jesus. Why wouldn't it be good enough for me? He goes on to talk about holiness in the next few verses. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. A life that is pursuing God's things, God's priorities, that is oftentimes deliberately a slap in the face of all the values that you see on television these days. All the values of your neighbors. All the me first kind of stuff. All the go for the gusto kind of stuff. Jesus says it's better for you if you will be holy in your thoughts, if you'll be holy in your conduct, if righteousness is what fills you up and motivates you and gets you through your day. That's going to be a better life for you, he says. Simply doing whatever you want to do, like we were saying before, you're no better than the animal kingdom by doing that. He goes on to talk about patience, and particularly patience in trials in the next few verses. Blessed are the peacemakers. they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Blessed are you when people shall insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you, he says. Rejoice and be glad, he says. Exceedingly glad. For great is your reward in heaven. See, chasing heaven is all about patience. It's all about being willing to wait. It's all about not seeking short-term satisfaction as your number one priority. Nothing wrong with being happy in the short term. Nothing wrong with having things in the short term. That's just that much more opportunity for you to glorify God. But real satisfaction, real contentment, real happiness, as Jesus defines happiness, real godly joy, is found in looking past such things, whether they're good or bad. Looking past that to an eternal resolution of these matters. Now, that may mean that you don't get the same kind of jolt out of short-term titillation as your neighbors do. But it also is going to take the sting out of the bad things. It's also going to mean that when things go poorly for you, have you ever had one of those days where bad things happen? Really bad things happen? Bad people doing bad stuff to you? Doesn't seem to be any way out of it. Doesn't seem to be any reversal of fortunes on the near horizon. Well, how in the world can I be happy there? The reason you're not happy is because you're focusing on the short term. Jesus says, don't do that. Realize that persecution in the name of Jesus Christ is a reason to be happy. A reason to be satisfied, because you're having confirmed in your own heart and in your own life that you're on the same path that Elijah was on, that Enoch was on, that David was on, and on we could go, of people who suffered tremendously and oftentimes lost their lives because they had higher priorities than simply what was going to put a smile on their face at any given moment in any given day. So persecuted they the prophets who were before you. And this is kind of the crux of the overall point that I wanted to make here. When you define your life, define the happiness, the contentment, the satisfaction in your life by what's happening to you right now, do you realize that that makes you a prisoner of right now? It makes you a prisoner of your circumstances, largely which are completely beyond your control. If you're happy on sunny days and miserable on rainy days, that's just pathetic, isn't it? Why would you want to live like that? Just kind of crossing your fingers and hoping things work out. If this president gets elected, then I'm going to be happy. If this person gets elected, I'm going to be miserable. Why live your life that way? Why would you want to do that? Why not instead find your happiness in Jesus? Why not instead find contentment wherever you happen to be? Good situations, bad situations, in-between situations, changing situations, the same stagnancy. It doesn't matter. Wherever you happen to be, find Jesus. Find your satisfaction in Him. And then you wake up, and maybe it's raining, maybe it's sunny, whatever. But instead of asking yourself what the conditions are, you ask yourself, am I a child of God? Am I walking in the light as He is in the light? Am I going to heaven when I die? And the answer comes back, yes. And that kind of sets you up for the rest of the day, doesn't it? What's going to go wrong now? When I know that the only really important thing in my life is absolutely going to go right. That's a lifestyle that I want to adopt. That's a lifestyle that I'm trying to encourage in my children. Kind of lifestyle that I encourage you to adopt. That, for whatever reason, is foreign to our neighbors and foreign to a lot of our brethren. I urge you to look at your life and look at where your satisfaction is being found and what you take true joy in. And if you find yourself complaining about your life, if you find yourself constantly miserable for whatever reason, I'm not saying you don't have problems, because you do have problems, I'm sure. So do I. I'm not trying to minimize such things. But surely it's far more important for a person of faith
to be able to find Jesus in our good times and in our bad times, and measure our degree of satisfaction and contentment and happiness on our relationship with Him, rather than in any kind of external factor, short-term factor, carnal factor, other factor. The only thing that matters is, are you Christian? The only thing that matters is, where is my soul? And that brings us to the invitation. If you are not right with God, you may be right with a lot of people. You may be right with your banker. You may be right with your accountant. You may be right with all your friends and neighbors and teachers and all the rest of that. But if you're not right with God, what difference does any of it make? No amount of happiness found in external things can possibly balance out an unhappiness that is rooted in a lack of relationship with Jesus Christ. So why don't you make that right? Why don't you come to the Lord? Why don't you put Him on in baptism? Why don't you rise up to walk in newness of life, a life that is Jesus-focused, other-focused, service-focused, rather than self-focused? And one of these days, wake up in heaven. That opportunity is yours. If there's anything we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly, including helping you into the water of baptism, if that is your need and desire, we are anxious to help in whatever way we can while we stand and sing at this time to encourage you.